Hey, this is Laura.
And Steven.
And this is our podcast, Midday Musings, where we take our lunch break to talk about the things that are on our mind. Today, it's movies, the British, and British colonial interests. Trevor Noah, Tom Hiddleston, Cillian Murphy, South Africa, a little something for everybody. Let's get into it. Hey there, Steven.
Hello, Laura.
How goes it?
It's going pretty well. I was a little sleepy, but I got some rest. I got some talking in, and it's energized me. So I actually feel pretty good. I feel a little blissful, like lightly blissful, even though still slightly sleepy. Yeah.
Lightly blissful.
Lightly blissful.
Oh, that's how I want to spend my entire life.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Lightly blissful.
It's a good state. What about you?
I feel good. Yeah. Yeah. I've gotten rest. I'm going to get more rest tonight. I'm going to devote my April to resting.
Oh, I love that.
I'm going to look at my content calendar, laugh at that statement I just made, and then devote myself to rest because we are booked and busy this month.
Oh, yeah. Like, for example, Tuesday track nights, I'm going to hit that hard. I'm going to be the fastest dude on that track that anyone has ever met.
Excellent. They won't even see you. They'll just see a blur.
No, they'll be like, is that the Flash? What the heck? By the way, I saw an absolutely bizarre thing, like a clip from the CW Flash show.
Tell me more.
All of them are like speedsters or whatever, so they can go almost at the speed of light. But they chose instead to harness their power into like lightsabers and then fight each other in regular time, regular human time. And I'm like, that's interesting. And I don't know what to do with that information.
Yeah, I don't know what to do with it either.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the TV shows, you know, they take some big swings, and I respect that. I remember when we saw the Loki TV show on Disney Plus. It was pretty good, actually.
Like, oh,
it was
yeah. Pretty no, decent. The Loki TV show was great. I don't know how much of that was just casting, because, like, Tom Hiddleston can carry a show as long as they're not asking him to be a hero. I've seen a couple of shows of his where he's the primary protagonist, but like the hero protagonist. It just is weird and wrong. Mm. Not that he does a bad job. It's just that your brain can't accept it. But the second you have him doing anti-hero stuff, your brain is like, yes, I'm engaged. Of course, we'll follow this man through his shenanigans.
He's just got a bit of mischief in his eyes, you know?
He does. He was doing a couple of shows in the 2010s where it seemed like he was auditioning to be like James Bond. Like there were a bunch of international pseudo-espionage thriller adventures. And like, I kind of believe that he wants to be James Bond. Like my conspiracy theory is that Tom Hiddleston is trying very hard to be James Bond.
I'm sure he does. I think every 40-year-old A-lister in Hollywood probably would like to be James Bond. Like male A-lister in Hollywood would like to be James Bond.
I think he would be so delighted to hear you call him A-list.
Is he not? Oh, is he not
A-list? I don't know.
Tom Hiddleston is an A-lister. Change my mind.
I actually think that's up for debate. I would love to hear the people debate his listing.
No, but like, I love that guy. He is just, he's a little naturally mischievous. And I think when he's not able to mischief at things, I think it makes him a little bit sad inside. He's like, I wish I could mischief.
Okay,
but I will instead be a romantic lead. Sure, sure.
Tell me if this makes sense to you. Tom Hiddleston is just a British Timothy Chalamet. And for that reason, because of his British accent, we cannot accept him as the hero of a story.
Oh.
And he must therefore be a villain.
Well,
because, like, we'll let Timothy Chalamet play Willy Wonka. We're like, yeah, his sort of, like, tubercular, emaciated, cute boy act works.
His Victorian boy ghost.
His Victorian totally ghost works. Boy thing. Yeah. His Lord Byron-esque appearance. It's fine. Because he's, like, a chill California dude. But the second you apply that same phenotype, like that same look to someone with a British accent, our American brains are like designed to believe that's an enemy.
They're like, oh, that's...
Or like an antagonist.
That's Daddy England. That's the bad guy. We don't like Daddy England. No, you totally have a point though. So the British accent elicits a couple reactions in the American brain. Either we naturally respect it and say, oh, this is spoken with authority because it's spoken with a high-born British accent. Or, oh, this is a villain because it's a highborn British accent.
I think it's the Britishness of it all, because it's not just the accent, right? Tom Hiddleston has played American, and like Jason Isaacs has played American, and like Helena Bonham Carter has played American, but our brains always think they're villains because they're English. But what we will allow is Scottish people.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Or Irish people to be the heroes. So, like, Ewan McGregor, fine. Gerard Butler, yeah. Be the hero of every dad movie for the last 10 years. And Cillian Murphy, totally fine. But it's the British. We will not allow a British actor to be a heroic lead.
But wait, we're talking about American movies cast by American casting directors who are watching them walk in, start with a British accent and go, hello, I'm Tom Hiddleston for blah, 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 reading for this part. And then they'll go into the American accent. Or Jason Isaacs will walk into an audition with his British accent and then do his American accent. So you already have the bias as the casting director.
Like, I don't know. I don't know the nationality of the casting directors. They could be Ukrainian for all we know.
That's true.
I just feel it's my belief that on a subcommunication level, a culture gives us the impression that you're good or you're bad. Somewhere in all of us is the belief that Russians are naturally villainous.
Right. And I've met a lot of Russians, and that's not necessarily the case. Like,
it's not necessarily the case, but we hear a Russian accent and we're like, guys, I think we should put on some Kevlar vests. That's all I'm saying.
So, you know, when I hear Russian accent, I don't necessarily think like the villain, but I do think maybe a little bit chaotic, maybe a little bit like,
maybe not villain, like tough guy. Like, so much so that like Trevor Noah, when he's afraid to go to the bathroom in the dark, does a Russian accent to give himself courage.
That's hilarious. Yeah. Dude, I love Trevor Noah. That guy. Did I tell you that when he was like traveling and podcasting at the same time, he was podcasting in hotels and he would check into these hotels and instantly he would just start looking around and snapping to himself. And the reason he does it is because he's trying to find the area of the hotel that has the best sound so he can record. But everyone who's seeing him at the front desk is just seeing, oh, I guess Trevor Noah is just a jazzy guy. He just walks into this hotel and just starts snapping right away.
Uh-huh. I like that idea. I'm snapping now. Right? He's like, he just seems so chumly.
Right. But no, he's actually just trying to like find the optimal like AV location to do a podcast. Anyway, I love his podcast. He's super hilarious in it, per usual.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm a huge Trevor Noah fan, too. I like his podcasts. I like his stand-up shows. I loved his biography, Born a Crime.
Oh, my God. And he narrated it himself.
If you get the audiobook.
And that was so good.
It was so good.
Oh, man. I knew very little about South Africa besides the fact that apartheid existed. I knew that was a thing, but I didn't know how far it went, and I didn't know like how much of it he actually lived through. And it was eye-opening, to say the least. Like,
oh, yeah, yeah. I learned a ton about it. So not just like South Africa, but Namibia was also impacted by apartheid. I recently read a book called Embassy Wife that took place in Namibia.
Oh, nice.
Having post-apartheid Africans as characters was central to the narrative. And what I have to say is that post-apartheid South Africans, people with living memory of the apartheid who are non-white, are easily some of the most interesting and wise human beings like I've ever encountered. They have this perspective on reality that is informed by the madness of like institutional racism, like a kind of institutional racism that an American can't even like conceive of.
Right.
Like, I just read their content, like consume their content. They know things about human nature that you need to know.
Oh, yeah. Because in his book, it wasn't even just there's like black and white segregation. There were other
categories too,
right? There were Japanese, Chinese, there were all kinds of different Asian groups that lived there too.
Oh yeah, and their classification was determined based on whether or not South Africans wanted to trade with them.
Yeah, so like the Japanese would get sorted into white. And I think the Chinese would get sorted into colored, which is insane because like arguably similar skin tone.
No, like that. Like, that's the crazy thing. That's the thing about people living in a post-apartheid national environment. They have had to confront like the absolute insanity of this institutionalized racism. Like the thing you just described, that people's categorization had everything to do with whether or not they were a valuable trading partner, thus revealing that the logic of the institution has nothing to do with anything except interest.
Right.
It's personal interest.
It's like it was less about color and more about money, more about who.
But the thing is, it's always about money, right?
Yeah.
Like that. And I think that that's maybe like the core wisdom that they have, which is that nothing is real. Like all of those rules that you have built around your society are stupid because the underlying logic of everything is whether or not you can get ahead. Like that's the determining factor in whatever choices are made in the national interest. It isn't real. It's the use of power for the benefit of the empowered. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important to know that.
And having known that, that's why you just got to go into hotels and just start snapping.
And that's why you snap. That's why you snap.
That's why you keep a jazzy disposition. And that's why Trevor Noah has a jazzy disposition. You learn a lot in that sort of environment. You know, we think it's bad here. And it is to some extent.
No, of course it's bad here. But like the new world has nothing on the stuff that was touched by the old world.
I know. And I love the perspective. I love learning that. I'm a little bummed that Trevor Noah, did eventually leave The Daily Show. But then we also had a ton of different rotating hosts, which was really fun because you got all these random comedians that you would have never seen running The Daily Show. But they're like, sure, I've got a week, a month. I can run The Daily Show for a while. And then freaking Jon Stewart comes back. What the heck? Who would have expected that?
Yeah, I actually really like that format where they just allow different comedians and performers at the desk.
Yeah.
Because Trevor Noah is incredible, no question. But like, he did it for 7 years. Let the man work.
Yeah.
It's kind of like how David Tennant was Doctor Who for 4 years and everyone was like, you do Doctor Who forever now.
Right?
No, they even let brought him man back work. Let the man work.
They even brought him back a couple of years ago. They're like, Christmas episode and you're coming back as the Doctor. Wait, what? Yeah. There's going to be a temporary, I don't know the specifics, but you're going to be the Doctor again. He's like, but there's been 2 to 3 doctors since me. This makes no godly sense.
But it does make sense because they had 2 doctors at the end of the fourth season. The Donna doctor, who was part human, who went to live with Rose in the parallel universe. That doctor can still exist, and he has continued to age because he's part human. And that's how you can get the extra doctor.
And that is the kind of beautiful, wibbly wobbly, timey wimey logic that I love about Doctor Who. They're like, well, we've got a loophole here because of all of the timey wimey logic.
Yeah.
But you're right. That is a good point. I guess it does make sense within the canon of Doctor Who.
Russell T. Davies canon.
I just thought they just brought him back and they're like, we'll just figure it out. We'll shoehorn him in because he's David Tennant. Everyone loves him.
Well, yeah. That's why we had 2 of them the end of season 4.
Dude, I haven't even seen like the latest Doctor Who. I think the last I've seen is the Jodie Whittaker stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I need to get caught up.
I know that they have a new Doctor, but I've not seen any of the new Doctor's stuff.
No, right? It's just good. The whimsy, the faith in humanity restored. I find that really just gets to me.
Even though the British are obviously villains in our own media.
Coming back to the British. Here we go.
Yeah. Even though that, they do create some of the most whimsical television content for children.
Yeah.
Like truly great stuff.
Superb, superb content.
And I really like the stuff they did in the 1970s. So that's your Monty Python's Flying Circus.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Blackadder period. They're dealing with Margaret Thatcher, right? And like a sort of fascist revival is happening in England in the 1970s. So in response, we have some incredible television show work
by
comedians at the time. The upside of every unfortunate period in history is that you're going to get great art.
Right.
Yeah. Everyone's just working full bore, like all cylinders firing on art when you have difficult geopolitical circumstances.
When the world is in a pressure cooker, that's when you make the most delicious content.
Art, yes.
Yeah, the most delicious art. It's true, you know, like there needs to be a bit of pressure for good, really good things to develop.
Just ask my Instant Pot.
Right? Like without pressure, it's fine, you know, it's good enough, but like, whether it's internal or societal pressure, without that, it's hard to produce a diamond, hard to produce like really good content.
Yeah, I don't know if like a positive environment, like all things going well, doesn't create great art. I just know uniformly bad times make great art.
That's true. There's so much art out there and I still have seen
so little of it. That's because the times.
I know.
Like if you have been around since 2013, like It's not great, but you cannot deny how good television has gotten.
You know what it is? Either your experience is good or your content is good.
Yeah, yeah. The escapism.
Yeah.
Category of the economy becomes really well developed.
And so either way, you have something to look forward to. Either like things are chill, you don't have it, like the world is fine, it's not in chaos, and your content's fine because people are vibing. They're out hanging out with their friends, yeah, and they're not like suffering and making like incredibly good content.
And right, when like the world... 50s? Nothing good came out of Hollywood during the 50s. Fight me.
My gosh, I remember taking a film class and I think we had like one movie from the 50s that we reviewed, and we reviewed like multiple movies from every single other era.
Right,
we
like watched the 30s and the 40s.
Yeah.
Yeah, the 30s and the 40s, incredible, incredible stuff coming out of Hollywood.
Oh yeah.
Because like, I mean, that's the depression in your like World War II years.
Yeah, we had Charlie Chaplin, you had Babyface, you had just a ton of good stuff that was coming out then. That's just
an that's old... the 1920s.
Was the 1920s? Going back too far. I went back too far.
Oh no.
Oh no. But the point is, yeah, like a lot of good stuff leading up into the 50s. And in the 50s, if there's like a couple movies that you love from the 50s, please send it my way. I'd love to be proven wrong. Mm-hmm. This is not about absolutism. This is about, I only know like one good movie from the 50s that I'm aware of, which is A Summer Place.
Yeah. But then during the 70s, movies start getting good again. Because the 70s.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The 70s. There was a lot happening during the 70s.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think in 1969, they're like, this is the end of innocence.
Yeah. And then we had Chinatown came out in the 70s, which was phenomenal. Yeah.
All of the stuff that George Lucas did before Star Wars, American Graffiti that got him famous, 70s. Logan's Run, the 70s. A lot of great sci-fi, a lot of great... I don't know what to call it, like The Outsider. There are stories about basically boys on the street. So I don't know what you would call that category of film.
The Outsider Boy. New York Lonely Boy.
Socio-political protest films. And like Network. Mm. I'm mad as heck and I'm not going to take it anymore. So good.
And then I think Alien, the very first
one. The very first Alien is like in the 70s.
70-something, 77, I think. You know, and that was just phenomenal. Phenomenal.
Yeah. Film. So like the background of that is that like the 50s and 60s are the end of the studio era. The studio system is what made the golden age of Hollywood, right? Yeah. Your late 20s, 30s, 40s. And then you start having independent producers like Martin Scorsese, like George Lucas, independent film directors who were making like films on their budget outside of the studio system. And that's when American cinema starts really getting good again.
Oh yeah. We forget because George Lucas has been a part of the machine for so long.
Yeah, he's the man now, but once upon a time.
But he was a small, indie, scrappy director coming up with American Graffiti. And even the first Star Wars was like, I don't know if I'd call it low budget, but he definitely took a lot of swings with it. And
oh, yeah. It wasn't an institutional studio project.
No. Yeah, he's the man now. But like, just like so many people before him, he started out as this just scrappy, indie director. And you got to remember that, you know, like... A lot of your favorite big-time Hollywood directors were once very small and very indie. And so I think they kind of carry that in their soul a bit.
Yeah, I'm sure they do. We all carry who we used to be in our soul.
I think it's important. Reconnect with your inner self, your inner British, maybe.
Your inner British man, your inner South African.
Your inner indie, scrappy director. Yeah, British being our roots and all, it makes sense.
Well, I think we've said what we need to say.
I think we have.
Yeah, let's give you your lunch break back.
All right, folks, thanks for joining us. We talked about a lot of things. We talked about movies. We talked about British people. We talked about Trevor Noah, South Africa.
And which is still British.
Which is still British. That's true.
Still British people.
We had a good time. Hope you did too.
Yeah, yeah.
And we'll catch you on the next one.
Bye.
Bye. This has been Steven.
And Laura.
Thanks for tuning into Midday Musings, the podcast where we talk about all the things on our mind. Be sure to follow us on Spotify and jump into the conversation in our polls and Q&As. We would love to hear from you. Catch you next lunch break.